So this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 24 course with, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. So check it out at certfuel.com.
It's a great resource.
Yeah, it really is. So we're diving straight into the regulatory matrix today. And I really want to set the stage here because usually when you study for a test, like, I don't know, the SAT or a real estate license, there's this underlying assumption that the material wants to be understood.
Right.
You learn a rule, you apply it, 2 + 2 = 4, but then you crack open the study materials for the Series 24 exam, which is this, grueling marathon test to become a general securities principal. And all that simple math just goes completely out the window.
Oh, it evaporates.
Yeah,
the Series 24 doesn't just test if you know the rules. It tests if you can navigate this landscape where, like, every regulator is assuming you are actively trying to commit a crime.
Right.
And you have to logically prove through all this paperwork and these strict timeframes that you aren't.
Yeah. And looking at the stack of sources we are pulling from today, I mean, it is staggering. We've got the Securities Act of 1933, the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, FANRA's entire corporate financing rulebook, SEC releases on RegM, RegD, tender offers, bankruptcy codes.
They do a lot.
It's a mountain of dense, frankly, terrifying legal jargon. And our mission in this deep dive is to synthesize all of it. We are going to extract the absolute most critical, highly tested concepts, but more importantly, figure out the underlying logic of why these rules exist in the first place.
Exactly. Because if you just try to memorize flashcards, the exam writers will completely destroy you. They thrive on corner cases.
Yeah.
But if you understand the regulatory philosophy, the inherent paranoia of the SEC and FINRA, you can logic your way to the right answer, even if you blank on a specific Roman numeral in the rule book.
Right.
I essentially look at my role today as being an exam whisperer. I want to show you the tripwires before you step on them.
Which is exactly what we need. So to make this enormous amount of information stick, we are going to use a story, a framework. Because reading a textbook is a great way to fall asleep, but humans remember stories. So throughout this entire conversation, we're going to track the journey of two characters.
Okay, I like it.
First, we have Frank the founder. Frank is the CEO of a tech startup called Frank's Flying Fedoras.
Okay.
They are literally hats with drone propellers in them. Frank is a visionary, he is charismatic, and he is a chaotic, impulsive regulatory disaster who thinks the rules just do not apply to him.
Right, so every investment banker's worst nightmare.
Exactly. Which brings us to our second character, Broker Bob. Broker Bob is a mid-level underwriter at a broker dealer. He has a mortgage, he has high blood pressure, and he sweats a lot.
Naturally.
Yeah. His single overarching goal in life is to take Frank's company public, get his underwriting fee, and somehow keep both Frank and himself out of federal prison.
That is a phenomenal setup.
Yeah.
Because the dynamic between a reckless issuer and a terrified underwriter is exactly what the regulators designed these rules to govern.
So let's start at the absolute beginning of the journey. Frank wants to take Frank's Flying Fedoras public. He wants an IPO. This brings us face to face with the Securities Act of 1933. Now, if I'm looking at this from a high level, the 33 Act basically breaks the IPO process into three distinct time zones, right? Like a calendar with hard borders.
Yes. So the 33 Act was born directly out of the ashes of the 1929 stock market crash. The government realized that companies were just hyping up garbage stocks, taking people's money, and then vanishing.
Right.
So the 33 Act is fundamentally about one thing, which is full and fair disclosure before a primary market sale. And to enforce that, they chop the timeline into three phases. You have pre-filing, the waiting period, and post-effective.
Okay, I look at these three phases kind of like the release cycle for a massive blockbuster movie. Let's talk about phase one, the pre-filing period. This is the time before Broker Bob has actually filed the massive S-1 registration statement with the SEC. To stick with my movie analogy, this is when they are just writing the script and filming on a closed set.
Right.
There's no trailer, there's no poster. What is Frank allowed to do during this period?
Absolutely nothing. It is a mandatory quiet period.
Yeah.
So no offers to sell, no offers to buy, no hyping up the stock. You cannot condition the market.
Okay, but Frank is Frank. He goes on Twitter and posts, the Flying Fedoras are going to change the world. Everyone get ready to empty your bank accounts next month.
Oh, boy.
He didn't say, buy my stock at 20 bucks a share. He just hyped his product. Does the SEC care?
Oh, the SEC cares deeply. That is considered gun jumping.
Gun jump.
Yeah, the SEC views any public communication that could arouse investor interest in the upcoming offering as a violation of the quiet period. And what is vital to understand for the exam is that this rule applies to both the issuer and the underwriter.
So Bob is on the hook too.
Absolutely. If Bob goes to a steakhouse and tells a bunch of hedge fund managers that a huge Fedora IPO is coming, Bob has violated the 33 Act, even if Frank's phone is turned off.
So they have to keep their mouths shut until Bob finally finishes the paperwork and hits submit on the SEC's ADG error system. The moment he files that registration statement, we enter phase two, the waiting period. The default clock here is 20 days.
Correct.
Going back to my movie analogy, the trailer just dropped on YouTube. The poster is in the lobby. People know the movie exists. They can talk about it, but the theater is not selling tickets yet.
That is exactly the distinction. During the 20-day waiting period, you can make oral offers,
yep,
but you cannot make written offers, and you absolutely cannot accept money or lock in a binding sale.
Right, because they're still reviewing it.
Exactly. The SEC is reviewing the paperwork. They want the public to have time to digest the information without being pressured into handing over their life savings.
Now, Bob is going to be doing roadshows during this period, right? Pitching
yep.
the deal. And he hands out a preliminary prospectus. In the industry, they call this a red herring. Why do they call it that?
Well, it comes from the red ink historically printed on the side or cover of the document. The red ink explicitly states, you know, this is preliminary. The SEC has not cleared this. We are not asking for your money yet.
Okay.
So the red herring contains almost everything about the company, the business model, the financials, Frank's chaotic history, but it typically omits the final public offering price and the exact effective date.
So they can collect what they call indications of interest. People saying, yeah, I'd probably buy 10,000 shares if it prices around $15. But none of it is legally binding. So Bob is just sweating, waiting for the clock to run out. Which brings us to phase three, post-effective. The SEC finally declares the registration effective. The movie theater unlocks its doors. The box office is open. Sales are finally permitted, provided that every investor gets a final prospectus.
Yes, the final prospectus must precede or accompany the sale. But let's pause here because you just touched on one of the most insidious tricks on the Series 24 exam.
Ooh, hit me.
It's the language surrounding the SEC's involvement. The SEC never approves a security. They only declare a registration statement effective.
Wait, I want to push back on that because to a normal person, those sound like synonyms. If the SEC reviews Frank's paperwork for 20 days and says, okay, you're effective, go sell, how is that not an approval?
Because of the philosophical difference between a merit review and a disclosure review.
Yes.
State regulators often do merit reviews where they judge if a stock is a good, fair investment.
No.
The SEC does not do that.
No.
The SEC only cares about disclosure. Let's say Frank's business model is explicitly taking investor money, putting it in a giant pile in his backyard, and setting it on fire.
Sounds like a standard tech startup.
Right, right. As long as Frank writes in the prospectus, risk factor number one, I will burn your money in my backyard, the SEC will say, thank you for being honest, your registration is effective.
Wow.
They aren't passing judgment on the quality of the flying fedoras. So if Bob gets on the phone with a retail client and says, hey, great news, the SEC just approved Frank's IPO, Bob is committing a federal crime.
Oh, wow.
It's an unlawful misrepresentation. You can never claim the SEC passed upon the merits of a security.
Okay, so terminology is everything. Declare effective, never approved. Now, what happens if Frank lies? Let's say he doesn't tell the SEC he's going to burn the money. In the registration statement, Frank claims he has a state-of-the-art factory in Ohio producing 10,000 fedoras a day. The stock goes public, people buy it, and a month later, an investigative journalist drives to Ohio and finds out the factory is just an empty dirt lot. The stock tanks to zero. Who goes down for this?
Under the civil liability provisions of the 33 Act, the issuer, so Frank's flying fedoras as a corporate entity, has what is called strict liability.
Meaning there is no excuse.
Zero. No defense whatsoever. If there is a material misstatement or omission in the registration statement, the issuer is liable to the investors, period.
Okay, but what about broker Bob? He was the underwriter. He put his firm's name on the cover of that prospectus. Does he automatically go down with Frank's ship? Because Frank lied to him, too.
Right, but the underwriter does not have strict liability. Underwriters, corporate directors, and signing officers have access to a magical legal shield called the due diligence defense.
Yes.
But it's not a free pass. To use it, Bob has to prove to a judge that he conducted a reasonable investigation and had reasonable grounds to believe the statements were true.
So subjective good faith is not enough. Bob can't just stand up in court and say, Your Honor, Frank has a really firm handshake and he looked me in the eye when he told me about the factory. I believed him.
Exactly.
Oh.
Ignorance is not a defense if you didn't do the work. The standard of reasonableness is what a prudent person would do in the management of their own property.
Let's test this practically. I want the listener to really think about this scenario because this is exactly how the exam frames it. Bob receives the registration paperwork. It's hundreds of pages long.
Yep.
Part of it is an audited financial statement prepared by a massive certified public accounting firm. Another part is a narrative description of the supply chain written by Frank. Think about the level of work Bob has to do here. Does Bob have to hire his own secret accountants to re-audit the math from the CPA firm to claim his due diligence defense? Pause and think for a second.
The exam writers want you to say yes, but the answer is actually no. This introduces a vital concept, the difference between expertise portions and non-expertise portions of the registration document.
Let me guess. The financials audited by the CPA are expertise.
Precisely. Legal opinions, audited financials, geological reports for an oil company, these are prepared by recognized experts. For these sections, Bob's burden of proof is much lower.
Okay.
He does not have to conduct an independent investigation of the math. He only needs to prove that he had no reasonable ground to believe the expert's work was false and that he reasonably relied on it.
I like to think of this like buying a used car. The expertise portion is the engine. You hire a certified mechanic to inspect the engine. When the mechanic hands you a paper saying the engine is great, you don't then go home, take the engine entirely apart yourself, and put it back together just to be sure.
Right.
You rely on the expert, but the non-expertise portion, that's Frank's narrative about the factory in Ohio. Frank is not an independent expert. He's the guy selling the car.
And for Frank's claims, Bob faces a much higher hurdle. Bob must conduct a reasonable, independent investigation. He has to physically send someone to Ohio to verify that the factory exists. He has to check the deeds, interview the suppliers, review the shipping logs. If he just takes Frank's word for it, he loses his due diligence defense, and he is liable to the investors right alongside Frank.
This is why investment banking diligence files are legendary for being thousands of pages long. It's purely defensive. But here's a wrinkle. Let's say Bob flies to Ohio in January. Mm-hmm. He sees the factory. It's beautiful. They are pumping out drone fedoras. He checks the box.
Okay.
The IPO process drags on because the SEC has a lot of comments, and they don't actually price the deal and go effective until June. Can Bob rely on that trip he took 6 months ago?
Absolutely not. The exam will heavily test the concept of bring down diligence.
Bring down diligence. What does that mean in practice?
It means refreshing the investigation right up to the finish line. The liability for the registration statement is judged based on the facts at the exact moment the statement becomes effective.
Mm.
So if Bob visited in January, but the factory burned to the ground in April, Bob is liable if they go public in June with a prospectus that says the factory is operational.
Yikes.
So right before pricing, and again at the closing, the underwriters demand bring down comfort letters from the auditors, updated legal opinions, and a final certificate from Frank swearing that no material adverse changes have occurred since the last check.
They literally bring the diligence down to the wire. Okay, so Bob has survived the SEC's disclosure gauntlet. He verified the factory. He didn't jump the gun. Now, naturally, Bob wants to get paid.
Of course.
Dealing with Frank has taken years off his life. He wants his underwriting spread. This brings us to FANRA's corporate financing rule, because the SEC just cares about disclosure, but FANRA, the self-regulatory organization for broker-dealers, actually reviews the economics of the deal.
Right. FANRA's mandate here is investor protection. They want to make sure the underwriter isn't fleecing the issuer, which indirectly fleeces the public investors. So Bob's firm has to file all the deal documents, the underwriting agreement, everything, with FINRA's public offering system.
Let's talk timing, because the exam is obsessed with timelines. When does Bob have to file this paperwork with FINRA?
It must be filed no later than 3 business days after the SEC filing. Or, if the offering is exempt from SEC filing, but still subject to FINRA rules, it must be filed at least 15 business days prior to the anticipated date that sales commence.
And the crucial part here is the no objection letter. Bob can get his registration declared effective by the SEC, but if FINRA hasn't issued a letter saying they have no objections to the underwriting compensation, Bob is completely paralyzed. He cannot sell a single share.
Correct. FINRA holds the final key to the gate. And what FINRA is looking for is whether the total compensation Bob is getting is fair and reasonable.
Okay, but how does Heiner Roe define compensation? Because obviously, there is the gross spread. If the stock sells to the public at $20 and Bob buys it from Frank at $18.50, Bob makes $1.50 a share. That's cash. Easy. But it's never just cash, is it?
Far from it. FINRA defines underwriting compensation extremely broadly. Any item of value received by the underwriter within the 180 days prior to the required filing date is presumed to be underwriting compensation.
Any item of value. Wait, so let's say Frank's company agrees to reimburse Bob's firm for the legal fees of putting the syndicate together. Bob's lawyers cost $100,000, and Frank pays the bill out of the IPO proceeds. Does HINRA count that as Bob getting paid?
Yes, because Bob would have otherwise had to pay his own lawyers. By Frank covering it, Bob receives an economic benefit. That gets added to the total compensation tally. What about finder's fees? Added. Warrants or options to buy Frank's stock in the future? Added.
This is wild. What about a right of first refusal? ROFR. Like, Frank says, Bob, you did a great job. I promise you have the exclusive right to underwrite my next two stock offerings. No cash changes hands right now. It's just a promise for future business.
FINRA absolutely counts that as compensation today, because ROFR has an assignable, measurable economic value in the banking world. Furthermore, FINRA sets strict limits on ROFRs. If the ROFR extends for more than 3 years from the commencement of sales of the public offering, it is deemed unfair and unreasonable, and FINRA will reject the entire deal.
Okay, so FINRA dumps the cash, the legal fees, the warrants, and the ROFRs into a giant bucket, calculates the percentage against the total deal size, and if it's too high, Bob gets slapped down. Now, you mentioned warrants. If Bob takes part of his pay in the form of securities, maybe Frank gives him 10,000 shares of Flying Fedoras instead of cash. Bob can't just turn around and dump those on the retail market on day one, right?
Right. Any securities received as underwriting compensation are subject to a mandatory 180-day lockup period.
Okay.
Bob cannot sell them, transfer them, assign them, or even hedge them by shorting the stock for 180 days.
I guarantee there is a trick question on the exam about when that 180-day clock starts. Does it start when Bob signs the underwriting agreement? Does it start when the SEC declares the deal effective?
The exam writers will definitely offer those as attractive wrong answers.
Yeah.
The 180-day lockup clock starts on the date that sales commence of the public offering. Not the effective date, not the closing date. The date sales commence.
The date sales commence? Burn that into your brain. Now, this broad definition of compensation creates a massive philosophical issue. Because if Bob is getting paid in stock, getting paid in future rights, getting his fees covered, his judgment might be a little clouded. He wants this deal to happen so badly, he might turn a blind eye to Frank's terrible business fundamentals. We have to talk about conflicts of interest.
Yes. FINRA Rule 5121 governs conflicts of interest in public offerings. The rule specifically outlines mathematical thresholds that trigger a conflict.
The 5% rule.
Correct. If Bob's firm, or its associated persons, receives 5% or more of the net offering proceeds, a conflict of interest exists. And pay attention to the wording there. Net offering proceeds.
Not gross.
Exactly. The exam will often try to trick you by offering gross proceeds as an answer choice. It is always net of underwriting compensation and expenses.
Okay, so Bob calculates his cut, and oops, it's 6% of the net proceeds. Or maybe Bob's broker-dealer actually owns 10% of Frank's outstanding stock from an early venture capital round, making them an affiliate. The conflict is triggered. Does the SEC step in and kill the IPO?
No, the deal can proceed, but Bob has to cure the conflict. He cures it by bringing in a qualified independent underwriter, or a QIU.
A QIU. Let's unpack this. Because on the surface, it sounds like Bob just hires a buddy from another bank to look at his math and say, looks good to me, Bob. Do they just rubber stamp the pricing?
Not even close. Think back to our discussion about the due diligence defense. The QIU is not just an advisor. They must actively participate in the preparation of the registration statement. And most importantly, they must undertake the full legal responsibilities and liabilities of an underwriter under the 33 Act.
Wait, hold on. Why on earth would another firm, let's call them Firm XYZ, agree to take on strict liability for Frank's chaotic fedora company just to help Bob out of a conflict?
Because Firm XYZ is getting paid to do it. Usually, they are brought into the syndicate and given a substantial chunk of the underwriting spread.
Ah, okay.
FINRA's logic here is brilliant. By forcing a truly independent underwriter to put their own neck on the chopping block, putting their own firm's capital and legal reputation at risk, FINRA ensures that the pricing of the deal and the diligence are legitimate.
Because they have skin in the game.
Right. A QIU will not let Frank lie about the Ohio factory because the QIU doesn't have the conflicting incentive of the 6% payout that Bob has.
The QIU is the designated adult in the room. They keep Bob honest because their own life is on the line.
I love that. Okay, so Bob gets a QIU. The deal is priced fairly. The SEC is happy. FINRA is happy. Now, Bob actually has to sell the shares. He has to allocate the IPO. And let's be real, a hot tech IPO, like Flying Fedoras, everybody wants a piece. It's going to pop 40% on the first day of trading. Bob's phone is ringing off the hook. But Bob cannot just hand these shares out to whoever he wants.
No, we are entering the territory of FINRA Rule 5130, the new issue rule, which strictly governs allocations of hot equity IPOs. The core philosophy here is that the public should have a fair shot at buying new issues. Underwriters cannot hoard the shares for themselves or use them as a currency to reward their friends in the industry.
So they created a list of restricted persons who are absolutely forbidden from buying a new equity IPO at the offering price. Who is on this list?
It's essentially industry insiders, broker-dealers, and their personnel.
Finders and fiduciaries acting on behalf of the managing underwriter, so like the syndicate's lawyers and accountants, portfolio managers buying for their personal accounts. If you work in the machinery of Wall Street, you are restricted.
Okay, let's test the margins of this rule. This is a classic Series 24 scenario. Bob is restricted, obviously. He can't buy Frank's IPO for his own personal E-Trade account. But Bob has a son. Let's say his son is 25 years old. He lives across the country in Los Angeles. He works as a freelance graphic designer. He pays his own rent, buys his own groceries, completely financially independent. Bob wants to allocate 500 shares of the hot IPO to his son's retail account.
Think about the logic of the rule for a second. Listener, Is the son a restricted person?
The son is not restricted. Bob can legally sell him the shares.
Boom. Why? Because of the material support test.
Exactly. Immediate family members of a restricted person, which includes spouses, siblings, children, parents, and in-laws, are only restricted under specific conditions.
One, if they live in the same household as the restricted person. Two, if the restricted person provides more than 25% of their income, which is the definition of material support. Or three, if the restricted person controls the family member's account. Since Bob's son lives independently and supports himself, he is treated just like any other member of the public.
The exam loves to test aunts and uncles, too. Aunts, uncles, and grandparents are not even considered immediate family under this rule. So Bob's Uncle Larry can buy the IPO all day long, even if he lives in Bob's basement.
Yep.
Okay, so that's restricted persons, keeping shares away from insiders. But there's another allocation prohibition that is slightly different. Spinning.
Spinning. That's addressed under FINRA Rule 5131. It is a slightly different flavor of corruption. While the restricted person's rule stops underwriters from hoarding shares, the anti-spinning rule stops underwriters from using hot IPO shares as a bribe.
Right, because during the dot-com bubble, this was happening constantly. An underwriter would call up the CEO of a massive Fortune 500 company and say, hey, I've got 10,000 shares of this hot internet IPO. And we're going to put them in your personal brokerage account. You're going to make $1 million by tomorrow afternoon. But in exchange, when your massive company issues $1 billion of bonds next year, you have to hire my bank to underwrite it.
That is the textbook definition of spinning. Allocating new issue shares to executive officers or directors of a public company as a quid pro quo for investment banking business.
Yikes.
It is strictly prohibited. If Bob's firm has received compensation from that executive's company for investment banking services in the past 12 months, or expects to in the next 3 months, Bob cannot allocate IPO shares to that executive.
The key phrase there is the expectation of business. But if Bob allocates shares to the CEO of a shoe company, and Bob's bank only does tech deals, and there is absolutely zero relationship or expected relationship, it's not spinning.
Right, the quid pro quo element is what makes it a violation. You still have to verify, the shoe CEO isn't a restricted person under the other rules. It's a dual-layer check.
All right, the IPO happens. Bob allocates the shares legally. Frank's Flying Fedoras is now officially trading on the NASDAQ. But because Frank is a madman and his product is terrifying, the secondary market trading is wildly volatile. The stock opens at $20, but immediately starts crashing towards $15.
Okay.
Broker Bob is watching his screens, having a panic attack, because if this deal breaks issue price on day one, his firm looks terrible and the syndicate loses a ton of money. Bob needs to step into the market and buy shares to prop up the price. But wait, isn't that illegal? Isn't that market manipulation?
You have just hit on one of the most fascinating contradictions in securities law. Welcome to Regulation M.
Reg M, the anti-manipulation rule that legally allows manipulation.
Essentially, yes. The SEC recognizes that during a distribution like a massive sale of stock, the underwriters have an overwhelming financial incentive to artificially pump up the price just before the sale.
Right, so they can sell the new shares at an inflated valuation.
Exactly. So Reg M creates what is called a restricted period.
Mm-hmm.
During this period, distribution participants, meaning Bob and the syndicate, are absolutely forbidden from bidding for or purchasing the stock in the open market. They cannot push the price up.
How long is this restricted period? Because this is another area where the exam writers will force you to do math. It's either a one-day restricted period before pricing or a five-day restricted period, right?
Correct. And it depends on the liquidity of the stock. The SEC's logic is that a highly liquid stock with millions of shares trading every day is very difficult for one rogue underwriter to manipulate. It would cost too much money.
Okay.
But a tiny, illiquid stock is easy to manipulate. So, to determine the restricted period, Deb has to check two metrics, the average daily trading volume, the ADTV, and the public float value.
Walk me through the thresholds.
If the stock has an ADTV of at least $100,000 and a public float of at least $25 million, it qualifies for the shorter one-day restricted period, just one day prior to pricing.
And if it doesn't meet that?
If it fails to meet either of those thresholds, it defaults to the five-day restricted period.
If you're taking notes, circle the word A and D. Both thresholds must be met. The exam will give you a scenario where the stock has a $50 million float way above the threshold, but the ADTV is only $50,000. Because it failed the ADTV test, it drops into the five-day bucket. And there's a third tier, right? The actively traded securities.
Yes. If the ADTV is $1 million or more, and the public float is $150 million or more, the stock is considered an actively traded security and is exempt from the restricted period entirely. The SEC basically says, this stock is too massive to manipulate. Do what you want.
Nice.
And Bob's responsibility is to calculate this and file a distribution notice with FANRA before the restricted period begins, so FINRA knows why Bob's traders suddenly stop buying the stock.
Okay, so that stops Bob from pushing the price up before the deal. But we have a crashing stock on opening day. Bob needs to stop it from going down.
This brings us to the exception in Reg M stabilization. Stabilization is the only time the SEC explicitly allows an underwriter to peg, fix, or stabilize the price of a security. It is legal manipulation, designed solely to prevent a disorderly decline in the price of a new issue.
It's the SEC saying, okay, just this once, to prevent a panic, you can prop the market up. But because it is legalized manipulation, the rules are draconian.
Incredibly strict. Bob can only place one stabilizing bid at a time per market maker. The intention to stabilize must be explicitly disclosed in the prospectus. He must keep rigorous daily records. But the most highly tested aspect of stabilization is the maximum price limit.
What is the highest price Bob is allowed to bid for Frank's crashing fedoras?
The golden rule is that a stabilizing bid can never be made at a price higher than the independent market. Specifically, the maximum stabilizing bid is the lower of the public offering price, or the highest independent bid in the market at the time stabilization begins.
So if an IPO priced at 20, but the market opens weak, and real independent investors are only willing to bid 18, what can Bob do?
Bob cannot bid 20. Because the highest independent bid is 18, that becomes his ceiling. Bob can bid 18 to keep it from falling to 15, but he cannot artificially push it back up to 20 against the will of the market. He can only maintain, he cannot inflate.
And if the market was hot and independent demand pushed the bid to 22, Bob obviously wouldn't stabilize at 22 because the rule says the lower of the offering price, which was 20, or the market, which is 22, so he'd be capped at 20. The logic makes perfect sense. He is a floor, not an elevator.
Exactly.
Now, after all this chaos, Baed has to close out the syndicate's books. He has to figure out who bought what, tally up the stabilization losses, and pay the other banks in the syndicate their share of the fees.
And Sine Ron does not let underwriters drag this out. Syndicate settlement must occur within 90 days following the syndicate settlement date.
The 90-day clock. Not 90 days from the effective date, not 90 days from the pricing date, 90 days from the syndicate settlement date, the day the issuer delivers the securities to the syndicate. Another classic timing trap.
They love testing that.
Okay, I want to take a hard left turn here, a pattern interrupt. We are going to leave Frank and Bob alone for just a second. Shake off the 33 Act. Shake off Reg M. Let's talk about the physical layout of a broker-dealer, because this is a massive area for compliance officers taking the Series 24. Let's talk about information barriers, Chinese walls.
This is all about containing material non-public information, or MNPI.
Insider trading fuel.
Right. An integrated broker-dealer has an investment banking department that knows all the secrets of upcoming mergers, surprise earnings, impending bankruptcies, and on the other side of the building, they have a proprietary trading desk and retail brokers who would love to trade on those secrets to make a fortune.
Naturally.
So the information barrier is the set of physical, technological, and personnel controls that prevents the banking side from talking to the trading side.
So the bank has a compliance department sitting in the middle, monitoring everything. And compliance manages two very specific lists to track this MNPI. If you mix up these two lists on the exam, you are going to lose easy points. Let's compare them directly. The watch list versus the restricted list.
Let's start with the watch list. When the investment banking team signs a non-disclosure agreement to start working on a highly confidential merger for a client, the compliance department places that client's stock on the watch list.
I picture the watch list like a casino eye in the sky. It is pure, invisible surveillance. The traders on the floor have no idea the stock is on the watch list. They are buying and selling it normally. But up in the compliance office, they are silently monitoring every single trade.
Right.
If Johnny on the trading desk suddenly buys 10,000 call options on the exact stock the banking side is secretly merging, compliance is going to tap him on the shoulder and ask some very hard questions.
That is a perfect analogy. The watch list is known only to legal, compliance, and senior management. Its purpose is surveillance without tipping off the market that something is happening. If you suddenly ban trading in a stock, everyone will know a deal is coming. So you just watch.
But eventually the secret gets out. The merger is finalized, the paperwork is signed, or maybe there's a leak to the Wall Street Journal. The deal is no longer a fragile secret, it's a reality. What happens to the list?
The security moves from the secret watch list to the very public restricted list.
If the watch list is the eye in the sky, the restricted list is like pulling the fire alarm in the middle of the trading floor. Sirens are going off, everything stops.
The restricted list is distributed firm-wide. Every employee sees it. When a stock is on the restricted list, the firm explicitly blocks proprietary trading in that security. They block the research department from publishing new recommendations on it, and they usually block solicited customer trades.
You're building a hard wall.
Exactly. You are building a hard wall to ensure the firm does not trade while in possession of market-moving information.
Watch list is secret surveillance. Restricted list is a public, firm-wide ban. Keep them separate in your mind. And there's a fascinating legal protection here involving the information barrier, right? What if a rogue trader somehow bypasses the wall and trades on a secret tender offer?
The SEC recognizes that no system is flawless. There is a safe harbor for firms. If the broker-dealer can prove they had a robust, reasonable system of supervision and information barriers in place, and that they actively enforce them, the firm itself might be protected from insider trading liability, even if the individual rogue trader goes to jail.
Oh, that's interesting.
But paper compliance isn't enough. You have to prove you actually monitor the emails and lock the doors. Because back to our theme, proving you didn't cheat.
Proving you didn't cheat. Perfect. All right, deep breath. Back to our story. Frank's Flying Fedoras is now a public company. Bob got them through the IPO. The restricted period is over. Frank is sitting on a mountain of cash. But being a public company CEO means Frank has a whole new set of rules to follow under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. Most notably, Frank needs to learn to keep his mouth shut. And predictably, he is terrible at it.
Which brings us directly to Regulation FD.
Reg FD, fair disclosure. What is the core philosophy here?
Historically, public company CEOs would have cozy relationships with massive Wall Street analysts. The CEO would secretly call up their favorite analyst and whisper, "Hey, our earnings next week are going to be terrible. You should probably tell your top clients to sell."
Wow.
Yeah, the hedge funds would sell, the stock would drop, and 3 days later, the retail public would find out they lost everything.
A completely rigged game.
Exactly. Okay. So in the year 2000, the SEC enacted Regulation FD to level the playing field. The rule states that if a public company or any person acting on its behalf discloses material non-public information to certain market professionals, or likely traders, they must make public disclosure of that same information.
So no more secret whispers to the big boys. If you tell Wall Street, you have to tell Main Street. But let's look at how this actually plays out for Frank. Frank goes to a charity gala in New York. There's an open bar. He's feeling chatty. He bumps into a portfolio manager from a massive institutional fund. Frank accidentally lets slip that his grown fedoras have a slight defect where they occasionally catch fire and explode.
A highly material piece of non-public information.
Absolutely. The portfolio manager's eyes go wide. Frank realizes immediately what he just did. He just gave an insider tip to a market professional. Now, assuming the portfolio manager didn't sign a non-disclosure agreement, because Reg FD doesn't apply if the listener is bound by a duty of trust like an NDA or a lawyer, Frank is in massive trouble. This was an unintentional leak. What is the time frame? How long does Frank have to tell the public to avoid the wrath of the SEC? think about it for a second.
The rule is strictly defined. For an unintentional selective disclosure, the company must publicly disclose the information promptly. And promptly is defined as no later than 24 hours or the commencement of the next day's trading on the New York Stock Exchange, whichever is later.
24 hours. The moment Frank or another senior official realizes the slip happened, a 24-hour countdown timer starts ticking above his head. He has to issue a broad press release or file an 8K with the SEC to tell the world that the hats explode. But what if it wasn't an accident? What if Frank intentionally called up his favorite analysts to warn them?
If the disclosure is intentional, the 24-hour grace period does not exist. Intentional disclosure requires simultaneous public disclosure.
Simultaneous.
Yes. Frank would literally have to hit send on the public press release at the exact moment he made the phone call to the analyst.
Wow. Okay. Unintentional means 24 hours. Intentional means simultaneous. The test writers will try to confuse you on that timeline. Now, you mentioned filing an 8K. Let's talk about the regular scheduled paperwork of being a public company under the 34 Act, the periodic reporting.
Every registered public company must file an annual report, known as the 10K. This is a massive, comprehensive document that must contain audited financial statements.
That's the big one. And then they have the quarterly check-in.
Yes, the 10Q, filed after the first three quarters of the fiscal year. These contain unaudited financial statements.
Quick note for anyone taking the test, there is no Q4 10Q. The fourth quarter results are just folded into the massive annual 10K, so you file three 10Qs and one 10K per year. But the 8K is different. The 8K isn't scheduled. The 8K is reactionary.
Right. The Form 8K is the current report. It is used to announce major triggering events that shareholders need to know about immediately. Changes in control of the company, bankruptcy, the resignation of a director over a disagreement, or firing the accounting firm.
So if Frank gets into a screaming match with his chief financial officer and fires him on a Tuesday, that triggers an 8K.
It does.
And what is the deadline for an 8K? Because if we just learned the RegFD deadline is 24 hours, it's very easy to mix these up.
The standard deadline to file a Form 8K is 4 business days from the occurrence of the triggering event.
4 business days. Do not confuse the 8K operational deadline with the RegFD accidental leak deadline. They are testing 2 different regulatory scenarios. And bringing this back to Bob, why does the underwriter care about Frank's 8Ks?
Because underwriters do follow-on offerings. Let's say Frank's company has been public for 2 years, and now they want to issue more stock to build a new factory. Bob is underwriting it. If Frank fires his CFO 3 days before the new offering prices, that is a material event.
Great.
If Bob doesn't catch that during his bring-down due diligence, and they sell the new stock with a prospectus that still lists the old CFO, Bob has failed his diligence defense. He must constantly monitor the 34 Act filings of his issuer clients.
Okay, let's pivot. Section 6, private offerings, the alternate universe. Because let's face it, being a public company is exhausting for Frank. He hates the 10Ks, he hates the 8Ks, he hates having 24 hours to report his mistakes. He decides he wants to start a completely new secret side hustle.
What's he making now?
He is going to build Flying Sombreros.
Of course.
But this time, he refuses to do an IPO. He wants to raise money privately. He wants to use Regulation D.
Regulation D is a series of safe harbors that allow companies to raise capital without going through the agonizing, expensive process of registering with the SEC under the 33 Act.
Right.
The trade-off is that you cannot freely sell to the general public. You are restricted in who can buy and how you can market it.
The SEC basically says, if you want to raise money in the dark, you can only take money from people who are rich enough or smart enough to defend themselves. Let's compare the different flavors of RegD. First, there's Rule 504, the small offering exemption.
Rule 504 allows a company to raise up to $10 million in any 12-month period. The benefit here is that there are no specific investor sophistication requirements. Frank could sell to anyone.
But the downside is the hard $10 million cap. If Frank needs $50 million to build his sombrero drones, Rule 504 doesn't work, so he has to upgrade to Rule 506. And this is where the exam gets incredibly granular. There are 2 paths, Rule 506B and Rule 506C. Let's look at the traditional path first, 506B.
Under 506B, Frank can raise an unlimited amount of money, but he is strictly limited on who can invest. He can sell to an unlimited number of accredited investors. So institutions, banks, and wealthy individuals with over $1 million in net worth or $200,000 in annual income.
Okay, so the millionaires are fine. What about normal people?
He is allowed to sell to a maximum of 35 non-accredited investors.
However, there is a catch.
Always a catch.
Those non-accredited investors must be sophisticated, meaning they or their purchaser representative must have enough financial knowledge and experience to evaluate the risk of the investment. You can't just sell to 35 random people off the street.
And the biggest restriction of all under 506B, Frank can do absolutely zero general solicitation, no advertising. He cannot buy a billboard. He cannot run a Facebook ad campaign saying invest in Flying Sombreros. He can only approach people with whom he or his broker has a pre-existing substantive relationship.
Right. It has to be a true private placement.
Yeah.
But what if Frank really, really wants to advertise? What if his entire business model relies on hyping up a massive crowd?
That brings us to Rule 506C. The JOBS Act created this a while back. It completely flipped the script. Under 506C, Frank can raise unlimited money, and he is legally allowed to use general solicitation. He can buy a Super Bowl commercial. He can take out a full-page ad in the New York Times yelling about his private sombrero company. But the SEC demands a massive trade-off.
Yes, they do. Under 506C, every single purchaser must be an accredited investor. Zero non-accredited investors are allowed, not even one. And more importantly, the burden of proof shifts dramatically.
How so?
Frank, or Broker Bob, acting as his placement agent, must take reasonable steps to verify that every purchaser is actually accredited.
So under the old rules, you could kind of just give the investor a questionnaire that said, check this box if you are a millionaire. And as long as they checked it and you didn't know they were lying, you were fine. Self-certification. Can you do that under 506C?
Absolutely not. Self-certification is an instant failure under 506C. If you want the privilege of advertising your private deal on television, you bear the burden of forensic verification. Bob would have to demand tax returns, W-2s, brokerage statements, or obtain written confirmation from the investor's CPA or attorney. It is a highly rigorous process.
Wow, okay. Let's quickly rapid-fire a few other alternate routes for Frank to raise capital without doing a full IPO. What if he goes overseas? He goes to London to raise money.
That falls under Regulation S. Reg S provides a safe harbor for offshore transactions. The core rule is that there can be no offers or sales made to a U.S. person.
And the trap there is the definition of a U.S. person. It is based on residency, not citizenship. If an Italian citizen lives in an apartment in Manhattan, they are a U.S. person under Reg S. You cannot sell to them. But a U.S. citizen living permanently in Tokyo, not a U.S. person, you can sell to them. It's all about where they sleep, not what passport they hold.
Exactly.
What about Regulation A?
Reg A is basically the mini IPO. It allows companies to raise money publicly, but with a much lighter registration process. Tier 2 of Reg A lets a company raise up to $75 million in a 12-month period.
Nice.
And the huge benefit of Tier 2 is that it preempts state blue sky laws.
Yeah.
Meaning Frank doesn't have to register the offering in all 50 individual states, which saves a fortune in legal fees.
And finally, we have to talk about how private investors ever get their money out. When someone buys stock in a Reg D private placement, they receive restricted stock. It is unregistered. They cannot simply log into E-Trade and sell it to the public. They are trapped.
Unless they use a resale safe harbor.
Exactly.
Rule 144 allows for the public resale of restricted stock, provided certain strict conditions are met. Typically, they must hold the stock for a minimum of 6 months if it's a reporting company. And even then, if they are an affiliate of the company, like a director, they are subject to volume limitations on how much they can sell at one time.
It's a slow drip, but there's a fast track if they don't want to wait.
Right. Rule 144A. Notice the A. Rule 144A is an entirely different beast. I consider it the VIP high roller room of the financial markets.
How does the high roller room work?
Rule 144A allows the trading of unregistered securities strictly among qualified institutional buyers, or QIBs. A QIB is a massive institution like an insurance company or a mutual fund that owns and invests at least $100 million in discretionary assets.
Right.
The SEC assumes that if two institutions, each managing $100 billion, want to trade unregistered, highly risky private debt with each other, they don't need the SEC to hold their hand. They can fend for themselves. So Rule 144A provides a highly liquid shadow market for private securities where retail investors are completely locked out.
All right. We are in the home stretch, Section 7, M&A, tender offers, and bankruptcies. The bitter end of Frank's journey. Frank's companies, the public fedoras, the private sombreros, they are all a disaster. The drones are failing. The stock price has plummeted. A rival tech firm sees an opportunity. They want Frank's intellectual property, but Frank refuses to sell. So the rival firm goes straight to Frank's shareholders. They launch a hostile tender offer.
A tender offer is an active, broad solicitation made to all shareholders of a company,
offering to buy their stock at a premium to the current market price, usually contingent on acquiring a controlling interest.
Okay.
Because it is highly coercive, it forces shareholders to make a pressure decision about a fate of the company. It is heavily regulated under the Williams Act provisions of the 34 Act.
The regulators want to make sure shareholders aren't panicked into selling, so they mandate timelines. If the rival firm launches a tender offer, how long must it remain open?
A tender offer must remain open for a minimum of 20 business days from the date it is first published. This gives the shareholders time to evaluate the math, read the board's recommendation, and decide if it's a fair price.
And what if the rival firm realizes nobody is selling, so on day 15, they panic and raise the offering price to sweeten the deal?
If there is a change to the terms of the offer, like an increase in price or the number of shares sought, the offer must remain open for at least 10 additional business days from the date of the change.
And Frank, as the CEO of the target company, is sitting in his office fuming. The SEC requires Frank to formally respond to this hostile bid, right? He can't just ignore it.
Correct. The target company's board of directors must provide a response to the shareholders within 10 business days of the tender offer commencement. They file a Schedule 14D9.
14D9.
Yes. The board must either recommend accepting the offer, recommend rejecting it, state they are remaining neutral, or state they are unable to take a position. But they must communicate a reasoned stance.
Now, we mentioned insider trading earlier with the Chinese walls, but tender offers have their own uniquely terrifying insider trading rule, the disclose or abstain rule under Rule 14E3. And this is arguably the craziest rule in the entire book.
It is incredible, Bride. Under standard insider trading rules, like Section 10B, the government usually has to prove that a fiduciary duty was breached. An employee stole a secret from their boss and traded on it.
Yeah.
There has to be a breach of trust.
Right.
But Rule 14E3 for tender offers throws that entirely out the window.
Let's give the listeners the classic Aunt Alice scenario. Aunt Alice is retired. She goes to her local coffee shop every morning. She's sitting in a booth drinking her latte. In the booth right behind her, two investment bankers are talking loudly on their phones. Aunt Alice eavesdrops. She clearly hears them say, "We are launching a massive $50 a share hostile tender offer for Frank's Flying Fedoras next Tuesday."
Okay.
Aunt Alice doesn't know these men. She owes them no duty. She didn't steal the information. They essentially shouted it at her. Can she open her E-Trade account and buy Frank's stock? Think about the logic.
She cannot. Under Rule 14A3, if a person is in possession of material non-public information relating to a tender offer, and they know or have reason to know it came directly or indirectly from the bidder or the target, they must abstain from trading. Period.
Wow.
No fiduciary breach is required. It is an absolute prohibition. If Aunt Alice trades on that coffee shop chatter, she is committing a federal crime.
The SEC essentially says, we don't care how you got the secret. If it's a tender offer secret, you are infected. Do not trade. Now, what if the rival company doesn't want to make a loud public tender offer? What if they just quietly start buying Frank's stock in the open market day by day, hoping to slowly take control? When do they have to raise their hand and declare themselves?
This involves beneficial ownership reporting. The magic number here is 5%. When any person or group acquires beneficial ownership of more than 5% of the registered equity security, they must file a disclosure with the SEC.
There are two different forms for this, the 13D and the 13G.
The Schedule 13D is the long-form disclosure for active investors. If the rival firm crosses 5% and intends to influence or change control of Frank's company, they must file a 13D within 5 business days of crossing the threshold.
Got it.
They have to declare their intentions, where they got the money to buy the stock, and what they plan to do next.
But if a massive mutual fund like Vanguard or BlackRock buys 6% of Frank's company just because it's part of an index they're tracking, they don't file a 13D, they file a 13G.
Correct.
The 13G is the short form disclosure for passive investors who have zero intention of influencing management. And the filing deadlines for a 13G are much more relaxed.
But let's circle back to the active investor, the hostile rival filing the 13D. The exam loves to test the amendment requirement. If that rival firm changes their position by 1% or more, they must file an amendment to the 13D promptly.
Here's the trap, the 1% change rule. Is that a 1% change of their own portfolio or a 1% change of the company's outstanding shares?
It is a 1% change of the target company's total outstanding shares. So if Frank's company has 10 million shares outstanding, 1% is 100,000 shares.
Okay.
If the rival firm buys or sells 100,000 shares, they must amend their filing. It is entirely based on the footprint they're leaving on the target company, not the size of their own personal pie.
Well, the rival company realizes Frank's drones are literally catching fire, so they abandon the takeover attempt. They back out. And it is the final nail in the coffin. Frank's Flying Fedoras runs completely out of cash. The doors are locked. Frank files for Chapter 7 bankruptcy.
Chapter 7 is liquidation. The company is dead. A bankruptcy trustee is appointed to sell off every asset, the desks, the servers, the remaining fedoras, the Ohio dirt lot, and distribute whatever cash it generated to the creditors.
And the Series 24 exam extensively tests exactly who gets paid first. This is called the priority waterfall. It is a rigid, unforgiving legal cue. You have to know the exact order. Let's walk down the waterfall.
At the very top, priority number one, secured creditors. These are banks or lenders who have a perfected security interest in a specific asset.
Like a mortgage.
Exactly. If a bank loaned Frank money to buy the factory and took a lien on the factory, they have first claim to the money generated from selling that factory.
Priority number two, administrative claims. This is a bitter irony of bankruptcy. The people who get paid second are the lawyers and the bankruptcy trustee managing the liquidation. Because if they weren't guaranteed to get paid, nobody would ever administer a bankruptcy. Priority number three, priority unsecured claims. This includes recent unpaid wages for Frank's employees and unpaid taxes owed to the government.
Priority number four is the massive bucket. General unsecured creditors. These are the trade creditors, the suppliers who shipped Frank cardboard boxes and never got paid, the unsecured bondholders. They all stand in line together here, sharing pro rata.
Priority number five, subordinated debt. Lenders who specifically signed a contract agreeing to stand behind the general unsecured creditors. Priority number six, preferred equity. And dead last, sitting at the very bottom of the drain, priority number seven, common equity. The retail shareholders.
Common shareholders almost always get absolutely nothing in a Chapter 7. By the time the water trickles down to level 7, the bucket is bone dry.
Let's test this with a complex scenario, because this is how they will frame it on the exam. Listen closely to these three parties. Broker Bob actually bought subordinated bonds in Frank's company before it collapsed, so Bob holds subordinated debt. Aunt Alice, our coffee shop eavesdropper, she bought preferred stock. And finally, there is a massive commercial bank. The commercial bank was a secured creditor. They had a lien on Frank's Ohio factory.
Okay, we have our three players. Sub-debt, preferred stock, secured lender.
The bankruptcy trustee sells the Ohio factory, but property values crashed. The bank was owed $10 million, but the factory only sold for $6 million. The bank takes that $6 million, but they are left with a massive $4 million shortfall, an undersecured deficiency. Now, the trustee goes and sells the remaining office furniture, generating a tiny bit of extra cash. Out of that tiny remaining pool of cash, who gets paid first? Bob, the subordinated bondholder, Alice, the preferred stockholder, or the commercial bank's $4 million deficiency claim? Think about the buckets.
The secured lender's deficiency claim gets paid first out of those three.
Wait, I have to challenge that.
Yeah,
because the bank was a secured creditor, they got their collateral, the $6 million. Why are they allowed to double dip and jump back into the waterfall ahead of Bob and Alice for the rest?
It is not a double dip. It is the mechanics of an undersecured claim splitting into two separate priorities.
Oh, splitting.
Yeah. The portion of the debt covered by the collateral, the $6 million, was priority one. The bank got it. But for the remaining $4 million deficiency, the bank no longer has collateral. So legally, they are simply holding an IOU.
Ah.
That $4 million drops down and becomes a general unsecured claim, which is priority four.
Yeah.
So the bank is sitting in bucket number four. Bob's subordinated debt is bucket number five, and Alice's preferred stock is bucket number six. Bucket four gets paid before bucket five. So the bank's deficiency is paid ahead of Bob.
That makes perfect sense when you map it to the exact hierarchy, the claim splits. That is brilliant. All right, we have covered an immense amount of ground. From the 33 Act IPO through stabilization, Chinese walls, Reg FD, private placements, all the way to Frank's Chapter 7 demise. It is time for the rapid-fire recap.
Let's do it.
We are going to hammer the absolute most critical, highly tested numbers and timeframes to solidify your retention. I will throw out the number. You give me the rule. Let's lock this in. 20 days.
The default waiting period before a 33 Act registration statement goes effective. Also, the minimum number of business days a tender offer must remain open.
24 hours.
The Regulation FD deadline to publicly disclose an unintentional accidental leak of material non-public information.
For business days.
The deadline for a public company to file a Form 8K after a major triggering corporate event.
90 days.
The FINRA deadline for a syndicate manager to close the books and pay the syndicate members, counting specifically from the syndicate settlement date.
180 days.
The mandatory lockup period on any securities received as underwriting compensation, counting from the exact date sales commence.
5%.
The threshold of net offering precedes that triggers a conflict of interest for an underwriter, requiring a qualified independent underwriter. It is also the ownership threshold that triggers a Schedule 13D filing for active investors.
Incredible. We have mapped the entire regulatory minefield.
We did. And the overarching theme I want to leave everyone with is this. Step back and look at what all these numbers and rules have in common.
Yeah.
They all assume human beings are inherently flawed, greedy, and bad at keeping secrets. The SEC doesn't trust Frank to tell the truth about his factory. Fianara doesn't trust Bob to price a deal fairly if he's getting a massive cut of the proceeds. The SEC knows traders want to trade on tender offers, and they know underwriters want to artificially pump up IPO prices. The entire Series 24 exam is testing whether you know exactly how these regulators force you to prove your innocence.
Wow.
Through due diligence files, through QIU opinions, through physical information barriers, and through relentless public disclosures. When you are staring at a corner case question on the exam and you are totally blanking on the rule, ask yourself one question. Which of these four answers proves I didn't cheat the public?
Which answer proves I didn't cheat the public? I love that. Because it means the Series 24 isn't just a random assortment of disconnected numbers. It is an organized system of paranoia.
It really is.
And once you understand the why the SEC limits stabilization bids, why FINRA locks up compensation shares, why Reg FD demands 24-hour transparency, the mud clears up. You aren't just memorizing rules anymore. You are seeing the regulatory matrix for exactly what it is. And that is how you survive, Frank, how you rescue Bob, and how you dominate this exam. Keep grinding, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.